You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Natasha Stagg, writer, calling me from Brooklyn. This is the second interview I've done with her. The first one, we were talking about her writing and a lot of events surrounding her book, Surveys. And today we're going to talk more just about the book, Surveys. Natasha, thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Natasha, Surveys is great. It's a great book. I really personally enjoyed reading it. But today, part of the reason we're talking again is I want to introduce the reader specifically to that book, since hopefully they've heard the other interview or listened to it after this. But your book, Surveys, can you just first introduce it? Because, of course, I'm going to ask you to read something from it. But to introduce the book, yeah, how do you see this book now, maybe? Because I was going to say, how did you, you know, which we talked a little bit about before, how it came to be, but how do you view the book now that it's been out for a while?
That's a good question. I guess it's been out for over a year now, and I'm seeing it as this, I guess it's changed a lot in my mind what it is, because I used to always describe it just as a coming-of-age story. And I know that that's what it is, and that's what I wrote. That's how I pictured it while I was writing it. But now, since I've kind of had to talk about it, you know, just with friends at least so many times, I've had to point out what makes it different. And I guess what that is the factor of the social media stardom and the protagonist becoming semi-famous over the course of the plot, and specifically through social media or some unnamed internet interface. And I left that pretty open to the reader, exactly how that happens and kind of the content that she produces. What that would be, if it is even content or could be called that.
Right.
So now I'm seeing it more as like this, like almost like an experiment that I tried with myself, like to help me to understand what was happening in the world. And looking back, it's kind of funny because it's such a hot topic, social media stardom or instant fame, and it wasn't really back when I was writing it.
Right. That's so interesting because, you know, I'm glad you are thinking of it differently, because I was wondering if that does happen. The book sort of has kind of a relationship with you that changes over time and interacts with events that are now as well as then, and will continue to interact with events in the future somehow.
Yeah.
Right. So it's sort of, I don't want to say it has different relevance at different times, but it speaks to different issues at different times.
Yeah, and it also seems to take on different shapes for different people. Like, I really love reading reviews or seeing, like, I saw this funny, like, video review of it the other day that really made it into this, like, pop culture expose or something. And, like, it was a nice review, and I appreciated it. It was kind of funny to see that and to think who would read it after watching that video. Or a lot of the reviews that I've read have mentioned the Kardashians or like these really huge stars that I would have never like compared my protagonist to, because I just think of them as like more than just a social media star. So it's funny how people can assign different current events to fiction that's as open as this.
It's interesting. Well, of course, I mean, that's happened with the, continues to happen, right? 1984, you know, by Orwell keeps getting signed all kinds of things and being reread in different ways.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear from it. If if you'd like to read something from it. What is the first excerpt you're going to read? I think we're going to read two if we have time today.
Okay, so this is the very first chapter, and it I don't know if it needs any setup because it's the first chapter, so I'll just start. Sometimes I would have to open the office, and the mall would already be open, and I'd sit behind the gate and see a small crowd accumulate. Sometimes it would be parents and their children with no snack in their hands from the food court and no bags or shoeboxes full of merchandise. When teenagers walked by and scoffed, looking like mermaids on ships, encrusted with rhinestone barnacles, their neon-accented phones and crap from Claire's, their banded braces and their piercings, they looked out of reach, even though I was only a couple years older. They belonged to the mall world, and I belonged downtown, where they would be the ones who looked out of touch. But I was in the mall, in my cage, and their decorations all came from the kiosks and stores here, and suddenly I wanted something sparkling pressed onto my body, at least a manicure. And sometimes I would be high, or coming down, or hungover, and the paranoia would mix with this gathering crowd and those passing mermaids, and I would be happy behind the bars, pretending to be printing out important documents before lifting the gate. I would feel the unfortunate families staring at me, hungry, and I would imagine I was a teacher in front of a class full of horny men. That's what fame must be like, I thought. The families would start to make friends with each other, explaining how they found out about this amazing place where you get a check for cash after only 1 hour or a few minutes. Their babies would grow up going to the mall without making a purchase more often than they would go there to shop. I wondered if this would turn them into mermaids or if they would resent this place. I turned on all the lights, and it was almost like a cheer what happened next, the squealing of the gate being raised. And it was almost like happiness what I felt right before I discovered the shame of magnifying our differences, and they came flooding in to see me. I can't decide whether I wish I had started off famous, the child of a famous person, just because then I would have ended up oblivious to the vastness between one status and the next. One day I was not famous. The next day I was almost famous, and the temptation to go wide with that and reject my past was too great. When I was legit famous, it was hard to tell when the change had occurred. It was traceable, sort of, because of the internet, but it was very quick. It wasn't quicker than any rise to fame before it. That's a misconception. Elvis rose to fame quickly. But with the internet, it was easy to see the fame, and so everyone had to acknowledge it. If I had been born famous, the moment I would have started engaging in social media, I would have seen this fame, not the rise of it. But first I saw the low numbers, and later the high ones.
Thank you for that reading, Natasha. In establishing that first character, how is it that that character entered this book? Did it feel autobiographical initially to you to start, or was that character based on something from other people you know or books?
Okay, so over time, Colleen, the protagonist, has become more nebulous in my mind as like who she could possibly be in real life. And so when I started to write her character, it was kind of like halfway through the book, like where the halfway point is now. That's like where I started writing. And that was like over 5 years ago, like maybe even 7 years ago. So when I started writing this book, I was in grad school and I was trying to write about just fame. I wasn't trying to be specific about what kind of fame, and I wanted it to be really open because I was fascinated by fame, but also dissatisfied with any book that I would read about a particular, you know, rock star, or like a fictional rock star was always like so weird to me. Like I never enjoyed, or I can never really connect to a fictionalized like movie star, rock star in a book, and just thought it sounded really cheesy. So I wanted to make one of those that wasn't cheesy, or that kind of made more sense by making it much more up to the reader, like what that fame was based on. So I guess I had some people in mind, but they were just kind of like people that were famous that I had met, you know, through just like being around Detroit, because I was going to school in Michigan and I would go to Detroit and see shows, and then it would be really exciting if you ran into like some like rock star at a, you know, like not rock star, but like minor rock and roll personality in like a bar. So I kind of had that in mind, weirdly, because it's not really how it translates at all. I know.
Yeah. No, but that's then, interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah, then I infused her with a bunch of internet stuff that I would come across and just be like, what is this? You know, like bloggers, like newer bloggers back then were not using Instagram because it didn't exist yet. And they weren't vlogging to my knowledge. And Twitter was a really new thing. So there weren't really like Twitter stars yet, I don't think. But people with blogs, I guess, were kind of an inspiration. Yeah, now she's become anything that anybody assigns to her, which I love, because it's exactly what I wanted to happen. You know, the idea behind it was like, if you could put your own idea of like the ultimate fringe famous person in there, and that worked, then I've achieved what I wanted to.
And are you going to read from another part of the book? What is the next excerpt that you're about to read?
Okay, so this chapter is about when Colleen, so she's still working in the mall. The first whole half is her working at the mall, which is the most autobiographical part, because this is all stuff that I used to do in Tucson when I lived there. So can you hear that honking? It's so annoying, isn't it?
I don't hear it, or it sounds very loud.
You don't? Okay.
No.
Good. So this is kind of her like daily life of going out and trying to meet guys. So this is just like one example of a guy that she meets. This chapter is called Javier. My friend had set us up when I told her I thought her brother's drug dealer was hot. Someone got up to get a burrito from the Circle K across the street and asked if anyone wanted anything. I couldn't bring myself to say yes, and I wanted a beer and a pack of cigarettes and a burrito from someplace other than the Circle K. This kind of night was something I'd thought I'd learned to avoid after it happened to me so often in high school. I couldn't always avoid the people I'd met in high school or even their houses, but I could get myself out of their condescending memory lanes when I saw them at parties, answering their smarmy, "What have you been up to?" question with getting a job at an office. The old junkies and stoner skaters I used to crush on and let intimidate me never asked what office I worked for, because to them all office jobs were the same, meaning beyond their capacity and also the antithesis of their lifestyle. Sadly, my degree didn't get me the job, and it didn't even help once I was there. I had majored in psychology, which had nothing to do with market research. It would be nice, actually, to know less about psychology working at a place like that. Julia had majored in business, and we were the only two employees who had finished college. Veronica had 1 year of community college under her belt, and Brian secretly told me he'd been kicked out of art school because he didn't get along with a professor there. "I want to go out, I think," I said to the group, still looking at my phone. The drug dealer named Javier said he could use some air. We got in his car and he drove east toward 4th Avenue, not south toward downtown where I thought he'd go. I didn't mind the idea of going to a crowded bar on 4th, since I'd probably run into someone I knew and have a way out of this date if it kept exasperating me. But he passed 4th. I was worried he'd take me to a sports bar where he could continue watching the game, or worse, to university, where we had our choice of 3 Irish pubs, a cantina, or the brewery, popular with grad students and alumni. Instead, he kept driving. He took me to a bar on Grant just beyond walking distance from campus. A normal dive, just not one I'd ever seen before. He ordered us a pitcher and we sat outside at a round wooden table. There were regulars talking to the toothy bartender in the way that regulars talk to a woman they've hit on and maybe slept with, but who they will always respect as a part of the establishment they rely upon, a non-fluctuating authority figure, more important than a friend or lover. I was still anxious, waiting for Javier to say something to me. The static of our interaction thus far was roaring in my ears. Javier had been quiet for a while, but once he finished a glass of beer, he began to talk. After two beers, he wouldn't shut up. I thought drug dealers weren't supposed to discuss their work, I hinted. What do you want to talk about? He said. You haven't asked me anything about myself. Once I'd said this, I realized how whiny it sounded, which got me thinking, why should I care what I sounded like to him? You probably don't even know what I do. You work at the mall. Yeah, I looked down. I hated him. You want another beer? No, I don't. I want a tequila shot. Anything you want. Anything? What about Patron? I had never asked anyone to buy me a drink they weren't already offering. Yeah, you want silver? Okay, I smiled. At the U of A, I'd learned that the world is corrupt and racist, and that the ground we walked on used to belong to the grandparents of the boys I dated. But the white girls still had it worse than the Mexican guys in neighborhoods like mine, because we had no way of defending ourselves against the gun that cops tried to ignore until a murder, until cracking down on Mexican violence could be construed as minority targeting. This was back before minority targeting became legal in Arizona. I learned that everything was fucked in the world, and that America especially was doomed because our country had grown up like a carefree nouveau riche socialite, and now we were being forced to do our own laundry, and who would commiserate when they had been doing their own laundry plus ours this whole time? And I learned that money is ascribed meaning, and that it is the one meaningful thing, since everything else has been either disproven or devalued in more drastic ways. Seeing money being spent on me was similar to getting it for myself. A group of men came to our table with him when he came back. Introductions, then shots, then the group went inside to play shuffleboard. After the shot, I was drunk and tired of Javier getting to do all the talking. I can't believe how badly this is going, I said. Badly? I don't need no new friends. I don't need something to do on a Friday night. I don't need to be shown new bars. So, I like my friends. I like this bar. But I like my friends and my bars, too. What is the point of all this? Of what? Of having fun? He didn't sound angry. Of being dragged around just to sit around and do what I'd be doing with my friends, but with yours instead. So you're not having fun? No, not at all. You want me to spend some more of my money on you? You want to see that? I think I at least deserve to look at it, I smiled. He took a fold of 20s from his pocket. You want another tequila? On the rocks this time. When he came back, I said, you know what this is like? It's like a payment. What do you think you're paying for? He got close to me. He was cute before, but now he looked sexy. Have you ever been paid for sex? No, but what's the difference, right? This is turning me on, said Javier. And he looked so cute and so dumb, I didn't care how much I hated him.
Thanks for reading that, Natasha.
Thank you.
So, that's a really wonderful section and chapter. I don't know why I particularly like that interaction and the, just the conversation as everybody's drinking a little more, talking a little more, and the whole self-consciousness that ensues is really wonderful, really beautifully written. In the last section, talking about how you put that character together, should we talk about how Javier was put together or what that scene means to you now when you look back on it?
That's another one that I think has only gotten more kind of obvious over time. Like, I think I thought I was being pretty coy back then when I was writing it and saying, you know, this whole book is kind of about surveys because she's taking surveys at the mall. That's her job. And so it's about numbers, but she's faking the numbers. And then eventually it's about getting numbers on social media, getting audience. So there's a monetary aspect to that. And I think I didn't even realize how one-to-one that is, or that would become, the whole monetizing your presence on online, and how it used to be this, there was this conversation, you know, the feminist conversation about sex work and how you can be a feminist and a sex worker, or you can't, or, you know, it's selling your body, selling your dignity, or, you know, there's like all these lines that you could cross or decide don't exist. And now it's kind of like every single person in the world has this opportunity to just create a image of themselves and then just monetize it, or at least use it for this kind of emotional value of that's numerically quantified. And it's like we're living in this kind of world that a lot of dystopic science fiction predicted, where we're all just, you know, these numbers.
And by numbers, you mean kind of comments, views, likes type numbers?
Yeah. And how much would your presence be worth, you know, or like what is the value of your created persona?
Well, and also you are, which you talk about a little bit in the last interview, you were saying, I remember that this is content world now, right, for writers and,
mm-hmm.
and producers. So, I mean, what I was thinking as you were saying just that is it's also what is the value of your content in a sense, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, how much of
that also sounds like numbers, right, as a, but your content, what does that mean? But it's, well, maybe it's not just content, it's also the attention that your content has received.
Right. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, it's about engagement, you know, or how engaging can you be for how long of a time, and, you know, it's like every metric counts for something.
Right. It is sort of like a perpetual dating game. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and now that you put it that way, where at any moment you could be kind of, you could lose favor or gain favor, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it's why it's funny trying to imagine this world, you know, 20 years from now when it's all sort of more normalized and nobody's talking about it anymore, and like what sex looks like in that world. Is it like this type of basically like a value exchange, which is prostitution? And so then it would become like not even a question whether sex work was moral or immoral. It would just be the norm.
Well, it's interesting when money comes into the equation for that, right? Because there, you know, there's different things happen when money is exchanged as opposed to maybe likes or something else,
yeah.
Right? I remember a friend of mine who was a sociologist and a bit of a kind of like troublemaker said he used to do this experiment in college, or did it once, where he would say to people after dinner, listen, I'd like to, thanks for making me dinner, you know, at their house. He said, I'd like to give you money for this because I can't invite you over my house because my apartment is too small. I can't cook for you. So in exchange, I'd just like to give you money so you know I appreciate it. Otherwise, you'll never invite me back. And he said, of course, they're very offended. They don't want my money and everything. And he says, but I tell them, but if you don't take it, you're not going to invite me back. That's the social norm. And, you know. And so, you know, he was just sort of saying then, as as is reminded when you say this, that when money enters into the equation, something else happens, as opposed to these other things we swap on social media, you know, including for, I guess, a type of sex or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I just wonder how long that kind of, how long we can continue to think that way when everything on social media is monetizable. You know, if you, even if you put up a YouTube video and it's just of your cat or something and it goes viral, eventually you'll make money from it without trying. You know, YouTube pays people for a certain amount, like 1 million views or something. If you hit a certain mark, then you start to get money from it. So it's kind of this funny thing where, like, all of the likes and the comments and the engagement actually does just turn into money after a while.
Right.
They are kind of one and the same. And it's funny, too, that, like, it seems like the most famous people right now, I don't know which one they like more, the money or the attention.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
I think they could live without the money and just have the attention.
Well, which makes the creation of it so different than what Hollywood and typical producers are, right? They don't have that. Because I think that's a really crucial sort of question. Like, well, what do they want more, the money or the attention? But that's a different,
yeah.
that's such a different question and problem than Hollywood or television producers have, right? They're not having that issue. It is about the money, right?
I mean, yeah.
Entirely, but this mix of money or attention, yeah, is very interesting, as you're saying, right? And only a product of YouTube and social media.
Right. Yeah, well, I think that's why certain stars of Hollywood resonate more with social media, or like current day stars, than others. You know, like everybody always wants to be Marilyn Monroe, everyone wants to be James Dean or Elizabeth Taylor. Those are the stars that had a more sort of dramatic or emotional relationship with stardom publicly than all the other ones, the more professional, you know, the ones that didn't die young or have 1 million marriages, like the ones that are super like tabloid fodder are the ones that resonate today, because it seems like they are the ones that needed the attention more than they needed the money.
But attention and money is also that seems to also almost be turned into a conscious recipe with, do you remember this character, Lonely Girl 15? It was a series.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was entirely produced.
I should watch it.
I never watched it either, but I just remember reading about it in the Times. It was the first kind of internet series that got covered like it was television, and it was completely constructed by somebody. There wasn't a Lonely Girl 15 who was, you know, homeschooled and living at home and talking into the camera about all her problems. But it was exactly that recipe, right? She needs attention. She's, you know, she's lonely,
yeah.
And the viewers are fulfilling that. And at the same time, it was, you know, Lonely Girl 15 was this sort of savvy soap opera, right?
That
reminds me of that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that those themes have always been around, but maybe just not so discussed back then, because it seemed like, I don't know. I think the easy answer is that everybody wants to be rich, but then more recently we've seen from like reality TV that kind of dismantles that. Mm. That like being rich isn't, even the really rich people still want to be on reality TV and to be totally embarrassed just to get that fame.
Right, that there's still something missing, even when you're wealthy, and that's it.
Yeah.
Which, of course, brings us back to your book, and which we've been talking about, and I guess to conclude, is there anything coming up that you want the listeners to know about? There'll be links in here. I'd like them to get the book or look at it. But is there any readings or anything you want to say before we go that they should know?
I'm writing something for a video series that will be in a PS1 show coming up, curated by Disc Magazine. So I don't have the details about that yet.
You're collaborating with another visual artist?
Yeah, the people at Disc.
That's exciting. So will we know the work when that show goes up? Will you be credited with that work? How will we know which one you were involved in?
I'll be credited. it's about reality TV stars, actually. So that's what I'm thinking about right now.
Well, Natasha, thanks so much. Perhaps we'll talk again in the future more about reality television stars. But for now, I want to thank you for reading from the book today. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me again. This was really fun.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.